Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. To give you an update, jailed Press TV anchor Marzia Hashemi appeared in court in Washington, D.C. today before a grand jury. Her children were also called in to testify and were not allowed to speak with her. No charges have been filed. We are desperately trying to get any detail on her detention from the FBI, but we have not been able to do so at this point. Her son, Hossein Hashemi, told the AP that his mother would have been willing to cooperate with the FBI and did not need to be jailed as a material witness. He says no one in his family can fathom why she would be considered a material witness for investigators. She hasn't been charged with a crime. She was born Melanie Franklin in New Orleans, Louisiana, most famous for anchoring news programs and presenting shows for Press TV. She was detained upon arrival at St. Louis Lambert International Airport in St. Louis, Missouri on Sunday, according to her family. She was transferred by the FBI to a detention facility in Washington, D.C. The U.S. officials have so far refused to provide any reasons for her apprehension, either to her or her family. At the time of this program, again, the FBI has not replied to Sputnik News' request for statement and charges on her status. Three Chicago police officers found not guilty over cover-up in Laquan McDonald's shooting death. Cook County Associate Judge DeMonica Stevenson has found three Chicago police officers not guilty of covering up details in the 2014 killing of Laquan McDonald, an African-American teenager. Former Detective David March, former Officer Joseph Walsh, and Officer Thomas Gaffney had been accused of falsifying police reports to protect Officer Jason Van Dyke, who was found guilty in October of second-degree murder in McDonald's death and is to be sentenced today. They face charges of conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice, but Associate Judge Stevenson said in her ruling, the state had not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the officers engaged in a conspiracy to prevent a criminal investigation and acquitted the three officers of all charges. What does this mean going forward? And let's get some insight into Associate Judge Stevenson's opinion. For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's one of the leading American civil rights attorneys based in Oakland, California, known for his work in police brutality cases representing plaintiffs. His law firm practices employment, criminal defense, DUI, personal injury, and landlord-tenant law. He is Attorney John Burris. As always, Attorney Burris, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you. Always good to be with you.
In a lengthy statement, Judge Stevenson said it was reasonable to believe an attack was imminent and the shooting should not be viewed in hindsight. Quote, it is not as simple as looking at the reports and comparing them to what was on the video. Your thoughts on her opinion?
Very disappointed in that analysis. It's the kind of analysis that provides cover for police officers generally. It is the kind of statements that were generally made and used as a basis to cover for police before there were video cameras. And as a consequence, judges and jurors often took the position of the police officers based upon the statements that they have made. Unfortunately, now we do have video cameras that contradict frequently what these officers have said. And this particular judge basically says, don't believe your lying eyes. Believe what the officers will tell you. And she substituted her own judgment. So it's an appalling decision. And her rationale to me is very, very disturbing. And it only shows the challenges that we, as African-American people who have been victimized by the police, face within the judicial system that is not necessarily a fair and impartial process at all. And the judges have their biases that they bring to the tables, and they use those biases sometimes to support positions that are consistent with those biases. And so for the judge to take a position that these officers' lives were in danger and that the cover-up itself did not occur because there was no real danger or belief that the criminal offense had taken place, is pretty shocking and very, very disappointing on the part of a judge. Now, I will say this. I have and was in Chicago for many years, practicing law there. I was there years ago when the Fred Hampton case was being tried, and the officers who committed that murder were being tried. And surprisingly, it was tried before a judge. And in my experience in Chicago, I certainly come to understand and believe that the Chicago judicial system is one that defendants pick the judges they want a case to be heard in front of. They are not necessarily cases where a jury is going to be heard, and as a consequence, they stand a better chance of being acquitted than they would be in front of a jury. So very consistent with my experience dealing with Chicago judicial system and Chicago Police Department.
You said, don't believe your lying eyes. And that, to me, is so eerily reminiscent of a case that I know you were very close to, the Rodney King case.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I was most disturbed by and shocked when I was doing this case at the time was that all the people who called in on the radio and those who were in the news interviews were all of the view that whatever was happening to Rodney King was his fault, and that the beating that he received wasn't that bad, that he himself had caused it. And it was like, don't believe what you're seeing. There's 60-something blows being struck here, and the officer not being struck at all, but you're yet to believe that the officer's lives were in danger. Well, here's a kid that's running away. The video shows that he is running away. And we see an officer step up, aim, and shoot him in the back. And the judge wants you to believe that the officer could have believed and that his life was in danger. There could have been a threat that was being posed. And as a consequence, the officers who then engage in the cover-up, who are trying to then cast us in a light that's consistent with illegal conduct, that they all that it was proper and just for them to do because there was no crime. That, to me, is shocking and hurtful. And if an African-American community, it would cause you to be distrustful of your judicial system, and rightfully so.
Again, the three officers, former Detective David Marsh, former Officer Joseph Walsh, and Officer Thomas Gaffney, were charged with conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice. And those charges centered around the filing of false reports in order to substantiate Officer Van Dyke's original claim that he shot Laquan McDonald because Laquan McDonald was coming towards him and posing a threat. The judge also said, I don't have the quote. I heard her opinion yesterday. And one of the things that she said, I tried to find the audio, but I couldn't. One of the things she said that really, really shocked me was the video that we see does not necessarily show the situation from the perspective of the three officers that were on trial. And so we cannot necessarily equate, or we cannot discern from that video what they perceived reality to be. And as such, she could not find them guilty of conspiracy, official misconduct, or obstruction of justice. My thing, having seen the video numerous times, is no matter where you were standing in that area, Laquan McDonald was walking away from Officer Van Dyke. His back was turned to him, and he was shot 16 times in the back and convicted of such. So that says to me, if three officers write reports that contradict the video that got Van Dyke convicted, what in the world is she talking about?
Well, that's the shocking component of it, because they had to write a report that was false, because that report had to show that Van Dyke's life was in danger in a reasonable way, when if you look at the video, it clearly will not show that. So basically took Van Knight's statement and his position and wrote a report that was consistent with that. Because to do otherwise, they would have to admit that at the very least, it looked like the boy was running away or walking away and was not charging them in any way. And for them to give a statement that was contrary to that clearly suggests, one, that they wrote a false statement, and it was based upon the fact of trying to cover for the shooter. That, to me, is a conspiracy and obstruction of justice. And they could have easily been found guilty. But the larger question, I must tell you, in dealing with Chicago's judicial system, there are judges that defense lawyers, particularly police lawyers, will always have their cases sent to because they know they're going to get the most favorable interpretation of the evidence in their behalf. And this turns out and looks like that kind of judge because you so clearly ignored obvious facts. And in order to do that, it suggests to me she had a mindset that was more favorable toward the police starting out than objectively unbiased.
Let's shift gears here, because as we're speaking right now in Chicago, Jason Van Dyke is waiting to be sentenced for the murder of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, which was in 2014. He was convicted in 2018. The special prosecutor argued that aggravated battery with firearm is the more serious of the crimes of which Van Dyke is convicted and should be sentenced consecutively on those charges instead of the second-degree murder charge, which carries a lesser sentence. The defense is asking for probation, and they argued that the aggravated battery charges are less serious and that Van Dyke should be sentenced based upon the second-degree murder charge. So basically, the defense is trying to get him to walk away, basically with time served on the lesser charges. Again, we're waiting for the sentence to be announced. They're going through the process as we speak, but your thoughts on the arguments from either side?
Well, it's understandable, of course, from the defense lawyer's point of view, they want to get the minimum sentences they can get for him. That's clearly understandable. I can't take exception to that as a lawyer.
Sure.
And the same side, the prosecution wants to get the maximum sentence. To me, this is a situation where the judge has to kind of cut through all of this and look to see the egregious nature of the offense itself. And when it does that, the judge could see that there are aggravating factors here. And the aggravating factor is that he was shot 16 times, and mostly in the back while he's walking away. That's not a typical second-degree murder-type case. That is really a first-degree murder-type case. And if you don't have first, then you still have aggravated battery. So it seems to me that the facts themselves suggest that the more serious punishment should be imposed, and certainly not a punishment that gives him probation. Probation is something that should not be given ever in a second-degree murder case, maybe in a voluntary manslaughter or involuntary manslaughter, but not in a second-degree murder case. That should be a prison case. And so to argue for probation in and of itself, to me, is pretty outrageous in terms of seeking to get a punishment that is not at all consistent with the harm that has taken place. A young man is dead. He should not be dead. He was shot a number of times in the back, and it was done egregiously because this officer stepped up. He wasn't even in the way. He stepped up and took aim. So this is a situation where deliberate conduct on the part of this officer to take full aim at a young man who was running away. That, to me, suggests aggravation and not mitigation.
You also have said a number of times on this show, and you and I have discussed this at great length, that one of the problems that we see in shooting cases of this nature is that the police officer will, in too many instances, place himself or herself in harm's way, actually create the dangerous circumstance, and then try to shoot their way out of it and claim self-defense, claim they felt they were in fear of their lives. And so what you've just said about Van Dyke stepping up sounds to me eerily reminiscent of what you have seen happen in too many cases of this type?
Countless times I've seen officers create confrontations themselves and then use deadly force as a way to get out of it and basically create the danger and then shoot their way out of it. This is a situation where this particular officer was not in harm's way. This was a young man that was walking away from them, some distance away. He steps up. Now, he steps up, and now he claims he put himself in harm's way in case the young man were to turn around and shoot at them, although he had no evidence that he had a weapon at the time. And so, therefore, he puts himself in a position in the event that the young man were to turn and face him, even though there's no evidence of that, but that's creating a danger that he claims that allowed him to use deadly force. Obviously, wrong. I'm glad the jurors saw through it. They didn't see any need for him to place himself out in a position that he was, nor did he have any need to fire the deadly force that he did. So the jurors got it right. But I can assure you, if that case had been tried before a judge, like the judge who just tried this case, he might have walked free.
That's the frightening reality that we find ourselves confronted by. Let me ask one more question, and thank you so much for giving me extra time. I greatly appreciate it. Been following on the Chicago Tribune site the sentencing, and it has not been announced yet. But one of the things that got my attention is they're now in the process of individuals coming up and giving statements on behalf of Officer Van Dyke. The head of the Fraternal Order of Police, President Kevin Graham, testified that Van Dyke's prosecution has impacted other officers and caused them to question their response when confronting violence on the city streets. Quote, "I've told them the law has not changed. We need to make sure we stay safe as police officers and that we go home to our families." And then he goes on to say, "They're leaving it on Van Dyke, and that's wrong. He's a quality individual who cares about society, the people he serves, and the people he works with." And then he goes on to say that that he's asking for leniency for Van Dyke, and that if prison is to hold someone responsible for wrongdoing, the Chicago Police Department higher-ups should be facing sentencing as well. I find that to be very, very troubling, understandable coming from the Fraternal Order of Police president, but troubling nonetheless. That tells me Kevin Graham hasn't learned anything with the massive number of police murders we have found ourselves confronted with over the past few years.
Well, that part is true in the sense that he doesn't care. But it's not because he hasn't learned anything. It's not that he's trying to learn anything. He has learned what he needs to learn and been trained. That police officers have a right to use deadly force if they perceive that their lives are in danger. That's all he knows. Now, that doesn't, but he's also saying, I don't care whether you disbelieve it or I don't care whether it was objectively reasonable or not. If the officer believed it, that's all that matters. And that's not the legal standard. And so this is another scare tactic on the part of the police union. I can only say this, Mike. The police union cares very little for the community it serves. It only cares generally about the officers. It's a union itself. They want more, more, more. Whatever they can get, whether it's more wages, more overtime, whatever it is, they want. But they don't have the same concern of the life of a community person than they do of the life of a police officer. The police officers' lives are to be protected under all circumstances, but not that of the community. And they're not willing to hold officers responsible for taking the life wrongfully of some third person. They could have easily have said that we think he should get leniency because he's been a good cop, whatever. But what he did, in our view, was wrong. That's all they had to say. But he deserves leniency because whatever good stuff he's done in the past, like everybody else. But you can't say that the shooting that he did was okay and that it's the higher-up problem and it's their fault for condoning this or not condoning this or how they trained them. Or allowing, what he could be saying is this, that officers in Chicago traditionally get a pass for the shooting and killing of African-American men. And as a consequence, we believe and come to believe that if we did that, that's okay. So now you tell enough on this one case that it's not okay. Well, you as the head should be held responsible because you have allowed us to do this. You have essentially ratified our conduct in the future or in the past, and therefore you cannot now hold us accountable when, in fact, you haven't held us accountable in the past. And so you, chief, you command people should be held responsible and not this officer who you've given a pass, and officers like him have given a pass on these issues, on ratification of this conduct previously. So why hold this particular officer accountable? You should be held accountable. That's what they're saying.
And, you know, for however good of a man Van Dyke is, and for all of the good that Van Dyke may have done in the community, and for all of the care and love he may have for the people that he served, when you add all of that up, and you multiply it by a billion, Laquan McDonald's still dead.
No, he's dead. And that's the part they don't get and don't care. A young man is dead who should not be dead. And it's because either the department has ratified misconduct in the past, number one, and then number two, this officer took on himself when he did not have to.
Attorney John Burris, as always, sir, thank you so much for your time. I greatly, greatly appreciate you coming to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you. It's always great to be with you, and have a good weekend.
You too, man. Thank you. You know, folks, quickly before we go to this break, let me say again, I'm on the Chicago Tribune website, and Officer Van Dyke's daughter has said she needs her dad in her life. And I understand that. And I would say to her, Caitlin Van Dyke, you can have your dad in your life when the McDonald family is able to have Laquan McDonald back in their life. That makes a whole lot of sense to me. Van Dyke's wife has said the police force has lost a great officer, to which I would say the McDonald family has lost a great son and has lost a great, great nephew. And so again, when you bring him back, then I would say that the Chicago PD can have their great officer back. And finally, Van Dyke's father, Owen, says that he stands behind his son. Well, I'm sure that Laquan McDonald's family stood behind his coffin at his funeral as he was laid to rest. With that, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it is Friday, therefore it is news roundup time. And let's go to our phone and pull up my guest. He's been a TV news reporter for more than 20 years. He's a senior Washington, D.C. correspondent. He has been since 2008, a reporter at large covering two presidencies, Congress and State Departments. He is Colin Campbell. Colin, as always, man, thanks for coming to the Critical Hour.
You got it, Dr. Leon. Good to be here.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your patience. Let's start with this. BuzzFeed News, who co-authored the bombshell report published last night, a report which claimed President Donald Trump directed his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie during congressional testimony over discussions between the Trump Organization and Russian authorities about a Trump Tower Moscow project. We now find out that neither of the reporters, Anthony Cormier or Jason Leopold, have not seen the evidence supporting their reporting. Your thoughts on this story and how it's been run repeatedly throughout the day?
Well, I think that the media is chomping at the bit for some kind of breakthrough to come. And I think we've been observing it and experiencing it for months now. There's always a new bombshell coming from the Mueller investigation. The special prosecutor has revealed something. And really, it just seems that Mueller has kept everything pretty close to the vest. However, what Cormier, the reporter on the BuzzFeed story, has been saying is that BuzzFeed has been following this for quite a bit of time, and that these are narratives that it has compiled from other various reports. So although there isn't any direct evidence, there are indications there. And I think that the overzealous media have been running the story incessantly because they're always looking for that next angle, the next thing to talk about for that 24-hour news cycle that is never ending. I would consider it somewhat reckless journalism, except that I don't know exactly if everything is non-verifiable, if everything that has been discussed in the BuzzFeed report is made up or not. From what it sounds like, again, they compiled news from various different sources. They didn't get this directly from Cohen, but at the same time, these are reports, and these are stories that they've compiled over quite a bit of time.
Now, you, sir, are a trained journalist. You are a highly trained journalist. I am not. I'm a political scientist with a microphone. So help me out, because you've got two guys, one of whom is Jason Leopold, and he has a dubious past at best. Came under scrutiny for faulty reporting for Salon in 2002 that led to an article being removed. In 2006, he incorrectly reported that Karl Rove had been indicted. He's been in trouble for perhaps claiming to have sources. And this is one of the things that gets me about this story. He's been in trouble before for claiming to have sources he really didn't have. And his stories just haven't washed. And executive directors and editors have had to apologize for some of his big blockbuster stories, of which this seems to be one. So we have a story where they're saying there are documents to support the position, but we haven't seen the documents. Our sources are unnamed. And I just find it quite troubling that if the sources actually came from the Mueller camp, 2 years Mueller's been locked down tight, not one leak. And now something like this comes out? I'm scratching my head saying, at 6 o'clock this morning when I heard it on one of the channels, last night before I went to bed, when I'm saying, this to me just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
There's too many holes in the Swiss cheese.
It's like Swiss cheese, right? Exactly. It is. I mean, he really can only go on his claims, on Cormier's claims, that a lot of his reporting goes beyond the people that are listed in his report.
In fact, let me interrupt you and ask you this question, because we're at 6:30 Eastern time, PM.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say the story broke at 8 last night. I'm asking you this as a journalist because this is supposition on my part. I'm turning to you as a professional to answer this.
Mm-hmm.
Usually on a story of this nature, between it breaking 8 p.m. last night, almost 24 hours ago, and now, wouldn't there usually be more added to it to support it? Wouldn't MSNBC or CNN or Washington Post or New York Times, wouldn't they be digging with backhoes to the point of being able to uncover more information about a story of this nature? To my knowledge, we're still dealing at 6:30 p.m. Eastern with the same sketchy stuff they gave us last night at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, and that is troubling, too. I don't know what kind of resources these other news agencies have in trying to get some more exclusive information. Of course, they've got tons of money, and I'm sure they have the staff.
And I'm sure they have better sources than BuzzFeed.
Might, but apparently, if what what Cormier's reporting has some veracity, he might have better sourcing than some of these larger outlets. Of course, we've seen the rise of BuzzFeed over the past couple of years too. I mean, we definitely didn't grow up with BuzzFeed.
Right.
There are, it's definitely been legitimized as a news source over the past few years. Now, has it reached the caliber of some of the mainstream media that we've grown up with and that people mostly turn to? No, it hasn't reached that level yet. But at the same time, it hasn't been totally debunked or disparaged as a non-reliable news source either. At least maybe there are a couple cases that have come up, but nothing that would totally derail the news organization like we've seen with some of these other online publications or news sources. But to your point, we really haven't moved far beyond the rhetoric and the narratives coming from news anchors that we heard almost 24 hours ago, and we're heading into the weekend. So I can only picture that news sources are trying to find out more information, but are definitely challenged by maybe not having the sources that BuzzFeed Suspect Cormier has. And then, of course, there are other things going on, too, that that are also grabbing as much attention, like the president's speech tomorrow dealing with the shutdown that has really just gripped the nation.
Final point on this. Aaron Mate makes a great point in his tweet about this story. In fact, it was an issue that came to my mind that, you know, the claim was two federal law enforcement officials involved in an investigation of the matter. What investigation is, if it was Mueller, it's strange that, again, there are leaks after it's been so tight-lipped after 2 years. If not the Mueller team, then where'd this stuff come from? And final question, too, to this. If Mueller had this, I would have thought he would have jumped on the president with this a long time ago. Because the reaction we're getting now, he surely could have used that reaction 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 4 months ago. Again, that's just another little data point that makes me think there's a lot less to this than they're making out to be.
Yeah, I mean, there probably is. I think that every month or every week or maybe almost every day, but definitely every week, there's some new point that comes out and it's supposed to lend itself to some level of salience that we're all supposed to consider as far as what the president's role was, what his involvement was, or what the implications may be. And when the media run with it, they run with it. And it's just continually on because everyone seems very interested in this story, especially as time goes on and taxpayers' money is still funding the Mueller investigation. Now, remember, Cormier doesn't say that any of this information really is from the Mueller investigation. He says that he has his independent sources,
right,
that he's been working longer than Mueller. So, again, if we are to take him at his word, then he just might have different kind of access that the news organizations have, that even Mueller has. But at the same time, we don't know for sure if the information that Cormier has, as infinitesimal as it may be, that Mueller already has it too, but just hasn't come out with it yet. It's, you know, it's not, it could be part of his report that he hasn't released yet.
My final point here, and this truly is my final point, the thing that initially got my attention was when CNN said, according to BuzzFeed, we have not yet been able to verify. When they put that disclaimer on it, I said, y'all are putting some stuff out here that you really don't want to be responsible for when it blows up in your face.
And unfortunately, when one media source runs it, a lot of the others follow suit.
And they all said the same thing. MSNBC said the same thing. BuzzFeed has stated, or BuzzFeed is reporting, NBC has yet to verify. I just find it odd, NBC, that you would be running with this.
With this.
Yeah. So, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
NBC has its followers and has its own viewership audience that would just grab onto this and just be immersed in it all day long, at least for the next 24 hours, right? And so I think that's part of what's feeding into it.
Let's do this. Let's take our break here. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the American anchor Marzia Hashemi, who was arrested here in the United States. And then I want to talk to you about Trump and Kim Jong-un are to hold their second summit meeting next month at a location to yet be determined. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Wilmer Leon here, and you are tuned to The Critical Hour. And Colin Campbell is my guest. It's Friday. It's the roundup of the big stories of the week. More ahead. Keep it locked right here. We are back, and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and this is Friday, and we are doing the wrap-up of the stories of the week. Colin Campbell is my guest, and I have breaking news. This is of about 9 minutes ago. This is from the Chicago Tribune. Jason Van Dyke, sentenced to 6¾ years in prison for killing of Laquan McDonald. According to the Chicago Tribune, former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke was sentenced to 6¾ years in prison today for the fatal shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, closing one of the most racially fraught and socially significant chapters in recent Chicago history. After a day-long hearing, Judge Vincent Gohan sentenced Van Dyke only on the second-degree murder conviction, finding that it was the more serious crime and the 16 aggravated battery conviction should merge into it for sentencing purposes. That means Van Dyke will serve only half of the sentence, less than 3.5 years in prison. This is breaking news. Colin Campbell, I know I'm catching you flat on this one, but your thoughts on...
Go ahead. It's good to see some justice, especially after those other officers were acquitted or found not guilty of a cover-up, of their cover-up allegations. And so it was looking very dubious as to how this would play out if anyone would be sentenced in the murder of Laquan McDonald there. So it's, you know, of course, this doesn't bring the young man back. This is, you know, and he's only serving close to, I think that is nearly 7 years. It's like it works out 81 months or something.
He was sentenced to 6¾. The decision means that he'll only serve half of the sentence, less than 3.5 years.
Oh, wow. And then, and he only needs to serve 2 before probation could be considered. So, you know, it is, it's good to see that a person was sentenced, that a police officer was sentenced. In so many of these cases, we see police officers being acquitted. However, it cannot go without being said that this seems like a very light sentence for murder, for taking someone's life. And, of course, this is something that is a little bit personal to me in the fact of my profile here in the U.S. So it's concerning.
It seems to me, this is just my opinion here, that the judge did everything in his power to give Van Dyke as little time as possible. So even though a 17-year-old was shot in the back, and as John Burris said in the earlier segment, that Van Dyke stepped up into the circumstance and fired those shots, as opposed to staying behind the safety of his vehicle and allowing the situation to play itself out, the judge seemed to ignore all of that. Look at the fact that this was a cop. Look at the fact that this was an African-American male and did this, as they said in The Untouchables, the Chicago way.
Yeah, exactly. It's unfortunate. It looked like the prosecution was really just trying to argue for a one crime, one sentence rule. There were a number of charges stacked upon one another in Van Dyke's case. And it looked like the judge sided with the prosecutor in that the one crime of firing upon McDonald and killing him was one crime, and that he should only be sentenced for that one crime as opposed to the several charges that he was already facing.
For the number of rounds that he discharged into the body of Laquan McDonald.
McDonald, that's right. There were about 16 counts that
right.
he was originally facing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move forward here. Trump, Kim Jong-un to hold second summit meeting next month. President Trump will meet with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un in late February. The White House announced today, continuing a high-level diplomatic dialogue that has eased tensions but shown little progress in eliminating the North's nuclear arsenal. The announcement came after Trump met for 90 minutes in the Oval Office with Kim Yong-chol, the former North Korean intelligence chief who has acted as the chief nuclear negotiator for President Kim. I'm sorry, for chair. I think his title is chairman. The White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, said the date and the location would be announced later, suggesting that the two sides were still haggling over the site or other logistical details. Vietnam, Thailand, and Hawaii have been mentioned as potential sites. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, I know you wanted to, we're going to jump into Korea, but I also know you wanted to talk about Marzia Hashemi as well.
Yeah, I was going to get to that after we got through Kim. Go ahead.
You want to get to, okay, fine. All right, no, we'll go to Korea first then. Yeah, I do believe that it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. Now, remember, the last summit was canceled originally, but then there was like a handwritten letter that was delivered to the president through a courier, and then it was reinitiated. I don't think that the White House will go through the same types of and North Korea will go through the same kind of bumbling types of diplomacy that happened the last time. However, we'll have to wait and see how effective it is, because remember, after the last summit, North Korea still tested a missile. It seemed to break down one of its nuclear facilities, but many experts said that was not a facility that was being used, that it was already decommissioned and that they were just imploding the tunnel because it really served no use to them. And we also know that Kim Jong-un wants to increase his international profile. He wants to launder his image in the media and in the public at large. So this would definitely be an opportunity for him to meet with the president and for the president to brag about a diplomatic achievement if North Korea does abide by whatever negotiation they work out. It would also stand to reason that after the last summit, where there was really nothing hammered out, it was kind of vague as to what was supposed to be accomplished and what the overall objective was. I think that there are going to be stronger calls of accountability for the White House to come up with something substantive coming from North Korea, rather than just a meet and greet for memorabilia to be printed and sold and the whole hoopla of it all. I think it's going to have to go a lot deeper than what we saw before. And what that depth is, again, it's really uncertain. It would be merely conjecture at this point.
I think there's a lot of validity to what you're saying. But first of all, I think if we look at where we were before the first summit and all of the talk about Donald Trump, you know, my button is bigger than your button and I can send more missiles your way than you can send my way and bring it on and, you know, all that other jingoistic macho foolishness, for it to have gone from that dialogue to where we are now, I think that in and of itself is nothing but success. And whoever wants to assign whatever level of elements of success to it, God bless you. The good thing is the hands are both away from the button, and that's a great, great thing. In terms of Kim Jong-un wanting to raise his international profile, I think that's mission accomplished. And the meetings that he's having in China, the meetings that he's having in South Korea, you know, the fact that the South Koreans and the North Koreans have now been talking about building and opening this railroad between the two. You know, I think that there's incredible progress being made here. The issue, or for me, the sticking point is the United States seems to be trying to go into North Korea and manage Kim Jong-un the way that the United States has been trying to manage Syria, the way that the United States has been trying to manage Afghanistan, the way that the United States has been trying to manage Iraq and Iran, and that is, here's what we're going to tell you. Here's what you're going to do. And only after you meet our demands will we then consider giving you something that you're asking for. And Kim Jong-un is a guy saying, I'm not operating that way. I think this is really going to be a test for the American ego. And Kim Jong-un is saying, you want me to do away with my nuclear weapons, you better get them troops out of South Korea. And you need to call an end to the Korean conflict. And then we can talk. And he's not backing down. So, you know, Mike Pompeo and Bolton, you know, you guys better start learning a different tune, because Kim Jong-un isn't playing.
That's right. And let's not forget that we do have a lot of sanctions in place over North Korea right now.
We do.
I'd like to see those removed.
Right.
Where he decides to indulge any type of request.
But see, to those sanctions, he's now getting relief from other players. He's not nearly as isolated as we initially thought that he was. So the pressure, the United States keeps talking about ratcheting up pressure on him, and there seem to be pressure relief valves in China and other places that seem to be interested in dealing with him as we continue to try to make him out to be a pariah. Let's move on because we've only got about 9 minutes and we've got to be sure that we talk about Marzia Hashemi, the jailed press TV anchor, American citizen, born in Louisiana, arrested in St. Louis, sent to Washington, D.C. Today she went before a grand jury and nobody seems to know. She's been labeled a material witness, but nobody seems to know what she's a witness for, what she's a witness against, what the charges are. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, I thought it was particularly troubling, being that she's already been detained and we're almost heading into a week. I believe she was arrested on Sunday.
Correct. So,
you know, in less than 48 hours, it'll be a full week that she's been detained as being labeled as a material witness for what case we don't know. We do know that reports about her incarceration came with the removal of her hijab. The food that she was being offered was pork-based, which would also be against her religion. So that there were violation of religious freedoms during her incarceration, which was also alarming. And the fact that she was held for a long period of time before she was able to reach out to family members. She was in court on Friday, but her relatives were disallowed from speaking to media. There were gag orders put in place. And, of course, she wasn't allowed to either. So a lot of this is just in a cloud of secrecy as to why she's actually being held, except for the fact that we know she's being held as a material witness, but we don't know why. Some pundits have also looked at the fact that it's possible that she was in violation of CFR 564.419, which disallows people from working with Iran, and even including members of media working with Iran, especially if they're U.S. citizens. And so that could be part of it. But again, we really don't know. But there has been a large show of support coming from various media organizations. And I think it's also very interesting that Marzia's detainment has reached the headlines of many news organizations here as well, some that many would consider to be mainstream.
Well, you know better than most how popular she is all around the world.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. I mean, her tenure, her employment with Press TV has gone on for more than a decade.
Yeah, I think she's been there 23 years.
20, yeah, it's amazing. I didn't even know Press TV had been around for that long, for 22 years. But
I'm not sure. Now, that's a very good point. It may have existed in other forms and, you know, have developed into what we know as Press TV today. I do know that she's been in Iran and been a journalist in Iran for almost 25 years.
Yes.
What this demonstrates to me, again, the hypocrisy of our government. If Iran had done this, well, as what happened with the Washington Post journalist, if Iraq had done this, we see how weak the United States has been as it relates to Saudi Arabia and Jamal Khashoggi.
Yes.
Just time and time and time again, when it's so easy, or what seems to be so easy, for the United States to live up to its principles and its precepts, it falls woefully short.
Yeah, it does. And of course, what's also as concerning is there are countries that look to the U.S. and follow its example.
Exactly.
We've seen where other countries quote the president in the killings of its own citizens. And not that the president has clearly said to do that, but they use what the president has said in order to justify something that many of us would see as morally bankrupt. And that just goes to show the type of impression that the U.S.'s actions can make on other nations. And especially when we are judging other nations and we are trying to influence them diplomatically based on our record, what they can do is point to what's happening with Marzia and say, why should we listen to you when you have a woman who was incarcerated?
One of your own citizens.
One of your own citizens, exactly. Because and she was a Muslim. You didn't seem to respect that. You didn't respect that she was a journalist. And is it part of your the diplomatic breakdown or the worsening of diplomacy with Iran that has been seemingly amped up over the past couple weeks with Pompeo's trip in the Middle East?
Yes.
Talking about Iran as antagonistic towards the U.S. and trying to get support for any type of any aggression that they may have towards Iran. So, again, all of this happening contemporaneously just seems very troubling when it comes to how she's being treated and the lack of information deriving from this.
This makes me think when I went to Iran and then I came back, I did a number of shows and I had a couple of different American hosts ask me, did you say anything about the Washington Post? Because the I can't remember the guy's name, but the Washington Post reporter that had been detained in Iran, I was there during that time. And they would ask me, well, did you say anything to the people in Iran or to anybody in the government about his circumstance while you were there? I said, no, I didn't do that. That's not what I'm supposed to do. And then, you know, they would say to me, well, you're just anti-Semitic. No, I understand what my lane is. And I tend to stay in my lane. That just made me think again about the hypocrisy in perspective as it relates to quote unquote them versus us. In about a minute and a half, Colin Campbell, what are you looking at for next week?
Well, I'm looking to see what happens after the president's address at the White House on Saturday afternoon, dealing with the border, with the immigration, and the shutdown. Of course, there's a lot of speculation if he would declare a national emergency to use federal funds to build the wall, since Congress is not playing with him on this $5.76 billion request that he wants to build the wall. But we also know that he would be fought with a lot of resistance from homeowners down there who don't want their land taken away from them, repossessed. We know that, but at the same time, we know that a lot of people are hurting from the government shutdown. People are selling things online.
I think what's not getting enough attention is people are blaming Donald Trump, but you really need to look at Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell is asleep at the switch here.
Oh, you know, it seems like it.
We got about 30 seconds.
Very much. I was going to say, I think he's very awake and aware of what he's doing. And I think that it is an injustice to the American people that he's not bringing bills to the floor to address the shutdown, which I think he knows most lawmakers would want to keep to reopen the government if he did put a bill on the floor. And that's why he's not doing it, because he faces a tough election and that could hurt him for his next election.
Colin Campbell, as always, sir, thank you for your time. Greatly appreciate you coming to the Critical Hour.
You got it, Dr. Leon. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, man. Really appreciate it. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week. We will be off Monday because of the holiday, but we'll be back on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Have a wonderful weekend. Peace and blessings. I'm out.